Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. As Americans, we are unapologetically obsessed with money and the people who have a lot of it. We are curious, to say the least, about how rich people make their money, how they spend it, and what separates them from the rest of us. A new book entitled Rich, The Rise and Fall of American Wealth Culture, puts the American obsession with all things money into much-needed perspective. Rich shows how American wealth culture, as we knew it, has become almost extinct owing to a variety of social and economic factors over the years. Larry Samuel, the author of this book, is with us here today. He's founder of Culture Planning, LLC, a resource helping organizations market to the wealthy, and has been a leading consultant to Fortune 500 companies and major advertising agencies since 1990. He conducted a study of the nation's wealthy for J.P. Morgan in 2000 and 2005, the results of which led Slate.com to call him the anthropologist of plutocrats, who aims to do for the American wealthy what Margaret Mead did for the Samoans. Larry, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Now, your book provides a history of wealthy Americans from the 1920s to the present. How is American wealth culture different today than it was back then?
It's very different. Once upon a time, there were basically two different kinds of wealthy people. You had old money and you had new money. Old money, those families who had been rich for generations, were considered by Americans to be superior in many ways to new money. New money, those who had just recently become rich, did everything they could to be perceived as old money. They joined the same clubs, they lived in the same neighborhoods, they went on vacation to the same places as the true upper class, hoping they would at some point be accepted into high society. But over the past century or so, old money has eroded to the point where today it hardly exists. So all the social markers we once associated with the wealthy elite, things like a sense of privilege, entitlement, discreetness, snobbery, noblesse oblige, are virtually extinct, part of the past. Today, we just basically have money, and whoever has more of it ranks higher in our social order. It's a little bit of a shame, I think, because love them or hate them, old money were a very interesting group of people.
It's interesting, the story you tell about the people with new money wanting to appear old money.
Yeah.
If we were in the UK, it would be people trying to buy lordships and castles and whatnot to carry around that mantle of landed aristocracy.
And we actually copied that in the 18th and 19th century. We mimicked the old world in wealth culture, and it wasn't until the 1920s after World War I where that evaporated. We went our own way.
Now, you did a research study for J.P. Morgan on the habits and backgrounds of the wealthy. What conclusions did you reach?
One conclusion I reached is that you have to observe what people do rather than listen to what they say to truly understand them. Because how people behave, which I define as how they spend the two resources we have in life, basically, time and money, is much more important than what people believe or say they believe, because it's not always the same thing. Meaning a different kind of research approach is needed. So I use an anthropologic approach, which complements traditional quantitative and qualitative research, which most marketers do. I'm not out to replace that. It's all good. But what I do with a group of people I call cultural stringers, I track rich people in their native habitat. So taking this anthropologic...
this image of people in blinds peering out with binoculars.
Well, if that's what it takes. Yeah. So I chat up doormen. I pretend to be shopping for expensive cars, expensive boats, and get thrown out of the occasional country club to which I don't belong. It's a dirty job, but somebody has to do it, you might say.
So it's sort of observing the wealthy in the wild.
Exactly. You got it.
Describe your five kinds of American millionaires.
There are five different types of millionaires. The thing to keep in mind, though, they're not mutually exclusive. So any individual can belong to a primary group, a secondary group, even a tertiary group. It's rare to find somebody just belonging to one archetype, but here they are. The first is thrillionaires. These folks subscribe to the idea that money is basically there to use. They want to make a lot and they want to spend a lot. So they basically enjoy the things and experiences that wealth can buy. Their money is a reminder of their status and success, that they've made it. Think Richard Branson or Trump, perhaps. My second group I call coolionaires. These folks view aesthetics as the essence of life. They surround themselves with beautiful things, beautiful experiences. To them, their money is an opportunity to express their status as a person of refinement, of style and sophistication. That's the way they view themselves. The third group are realionaires, and these are the millionaire next door. These folks stay under the radar of the trappings of wealth. They really have no interest in displaying how much money they have. They are willing to spend a lot of money on the things they think matter, things like education or quality product, but they're going to save in a big way on things that don't. They do not waste their money. So to them, their wealth is an indicator that they're smart and savvy and astute, that they've beat the system. They look at life as a game and they've won the game. My fourth group are wellionaires. These guys and gals are grounded in the pursuit of wellness, 360-degree wellness, I call it. They want to look good. They want to feel healthy. They want to think positive. They're going off to Costa Rica for yoga retreats and that sort of thing. And they want to live a life in balance. So their wealth is an opportunity to do that in a big way. They also like Eastern philosophy, spirituality, that sort of stuff. And then last, I have willionaires. These folks recognize that they have a privilege and a responsibility in some way to make the world a better place. So they want to give back. They want to make a mark. They want to be remembered. It's basically life in perpetuity. They want to live forever in some ways, leaving their mark through other people or through institutions, through
right.
philanthropy.
Legacy is a very important thing.
It's all about legacy. To them, their money is basically an opportunity to achieve life's biggest reward, which is to help others. The thing to keep in mind, though, is it's actually a hierarchy. I found over time and with more money, people walk through these levels of wealth from trillionaire to billionaire. They're basically a work in progress. That was a really interesting finding for me.
Larry, given the current economic crisis and your field observations, your sociologic approach to this topic, how are the rich surviving?
Pretty well, actually, despite what the media will tell you. Let's say your average millionaire might have 25 or 50 or 100 million or less, let's say 5 million, and you've given back a third or a half, as most of us have done. By any historical or comparative measure, that is an enormous amount of money. And they've made a bunch back too already. They've made a third or a half of it back. So I have no doubt the rich will survive this crisis. They've survived others of the past. The first thing to go are luxuries. Cutting back on luxuries is always the principal way they keep afloat, which is why positioning your brand as a luxury is almost always a mistake. In the book, I write about how the rich were hit hard by previous economic crises of the 30s and the Depression and the recession of the 70s. But every time they eventually bounce back to become, as a group at least, even richer. So there's always a bigger, faster way to make tons of money waiting in the wings. I think there's one now. We just don't know what it is or when it'll get here. But it's a matter of time before we get to that next one. Reports of the death of the wealthy are greatly exaggerated, despite what a lot of the media will tell you. And those that are predicting their demise really just don't know their history. The rich are a lot like insects. They're incredibly adaptive, and they, or at least their money, will be around long after the rest of us have disappeared.
I have a question for you. Your book is primarily concerned with American wealth and American rich. Can you offer any global perspectives on people who are not Americans who are wealthy?
What seems to be happening is we're just becoming more of a global player in every dimension of life, including wealth culture. The Russians, for example, overtook us during the boom in 2005 and 2006 in terms of millionaires and in terms of billionaires, even more importantly. So we are just one of a number of players. There's going to be a lot more wealthy people around the world in the decades to come, and that's okay.
Do you find there's a global definition for wealth? So do these newly rich in other countries hold as their goal or their target the representational or symbolic trappings that the American wealthy hold? Are they after that?
It really depends on the culture. And there is still more of the new money, old money paradigm in other cultures. So as you talked about earlier with the UK, old money is very important, or just family, even more so than money, in fact. Whereas in Russia and other parts of Asia, it's all about conspicuous consumption. I mean, these folks have chandeliers in their bathroom. I'm not kidding. So they're outdoing us. They're making us look like the millionaire next door in Russia.
And to wrap this up here, what are some key ways managers and marketers can position their products to the wealthy, especially now?
The key to marketing to the wealthy, or really any group of people, I think, is linking your brands to what I call consumer passion points. By that, I mean we're in a passion-based economy. The most successful companies are those which are able to ground their products or services in consumer passions, which are things or experiences which resonate on a sort of visceral or palpable level. You feel it. You know when you've hit a passion point. And the only way to discover those passions is to get out into the field and document, just as an anthropologist documents the behavior of a particular group of people he or she is studying, you have to go out there and observe it. Yogi Berra said, you can observe a lot by watching.
We've been speaking to Larry Samuel, author of the book Rich, The Rise and Fall of American Wealth Culture. Larry, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Remember, we'd really like your feedback, so please drop us an email note at podcast@amanet.org or call us at 800-697-3406. That's 800-697-3406. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.